This will be a tape recording of an archives interview with Vivian Hinton of Vacaville, California. This archives interview was done on July the 27th, 1986, and at that time, Vivian Hinton had been sober over 39 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The interesting aspect of this archives interview is that Vivian Hinton had drank with Bill Wilson prior to the time that Bill Wilson had sobered up. Vivian Hinton herself did not get sober until October the 28th, 1946. The original recording of this interview was made by Bill Cross, serving as the archives chairman for the California Northern Interior Area of Alcoholics Anonymous. This tape recording was produced from a copy of that interview by Bill and Diana Cross of Ash Tree Fellowship Tapes, located at 4588 North Meridian, Fresno, California, 93726. Phone number 209-229-8244. This tape was produced and preserved in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry this message, and members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's tradition number 11 regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in their use of this tape. The total playing time of this recording will be approximately 2 hours and 51 minutes and will of necessity cover 2 tape recordings. The interview ends rather abruptly when the recorder ran out of tape. However, the interview only went on approximately 1 or 2 or more minutes. Archives interview with Vivian Hinton of Leisuretown outside of Vacaville, California. This interview is being done on July the 27th, 1986, in Vivian's home. This will be an interview conducted by Bill Cross, the Archives Chairman for the Northern California Interior Area, and for the Archives Committee, and for the use of the archivist or researchers. And Vivian, just a question, do you have any objection to other AA members hearing the tape?
None at all.
Or researchers?
Not at all.
Having access to it. Okay, well, as you were starting to explain about Emil and starting there, you've been on a trip. Go ahead.
To start with, my husband and I owned restaurants in Miami, Florida, 2 of them. And in the springtime, we always closed them and headed north. We also owned a restaurant at the Breakers, the Manny Katz Breakers in Atlantic City. We were heading north to open the Breakers restaurant, but we were drinking all the way up. And so instead of going straight up 17, some way, we wound up in Akron, Ohio. My husband and I always had a rule. We checked into a hotel. We went in with 3 jugs, 3 bottles. One for him, one for me, and one for the morning. And this morning I woke up, and my husband had gotten up ahead of me, and he had cracked the 3rd bottle and drank a good part of it. I took the bottle away from him. Of course, it was my bottle. He drank into my chair. And he wasn't well enough yet. He was very, very ill. And he kept asking me for more. He kept saying, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And my husband was Jewish. And I would sit in the middle of the bed, hugging my bottle, telling him, die, you damn Jew, die. You drank my booze, now die. And finally he said to me, really, honey, I'm sick. Will you get a doctor? And I was very nice. I reached over, picked up the phone, and called for the house physician. And the house physician came. We both were in bad shape, bad shape. And God started working in our lives right then, because the house physician who came in was Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob offered to take both of us to the hospital. I wouldn't go. But Emil went. And I went on to New York. Emil stayed in the hospital, and he stayed there with Bob for 30 days. And he came home, and all he had was some little thou shalt things with him, you know. And I wasn't about to be thou shalted. He stayed sober. He went ahead with our business. And then he was to get in touch with AA in New York. And when we got in touch with AA in New York, he came to me at home and he said, guess who is behind all this? I said, I don't know, who? And he said, remember long, lanky, big-eared Willie Wilson? And I said, yeah. And he said, hell, he's one of the people that thought this up. Now, we used to call him Wee Willie, but Bill Wilson used to drink with us at a place called the Metropole on Broadway. And he had disappeared. We didn't pay attention to him, you know. He was kind of in the habit of disappearing sometimes for 6 months or so at a time. But this time he wound up sober. My husband tried to protect me then. He wanted to get me sober. We already had one person working for us. We lived out on Hempstead Island. And he locked me in my room, took all my clothes away from me, hired a nurse for a night, let my little colored girl take care of me in the daytime, and he went on about his business. And, you know, there's something about being a protected drunk. I remember one time I crawled out of the window, went down to our boathouse, got an oilskin slicker and walked 3 miles to a bar and got drunk. And they took me home. Then I decided to leave home. Because, you see, the worst thing that can happen to a woman is that I had lost my front man. I had lost my protection. I had lost my drinking partner. And I couldn't take it anymore. So I packed a suitcase, got a money belt, filled it with money, and packed my suitcase to go. I put old granddad and a few sanitary needs in it and left home. I knew that Emil would look for me, so I hitchhiked. It took me 9 months to get to Portland, Oregon. It took me 3 months in Portland, Oregon to hit Burnside, which is a skid row. I traveled a lot from then on. I don't think you want all of my drunk along. But I traveled a lot from then on. I wound up in the Panama Canal Zone in Havana, Cuba, back to Miami, back to Los Angeles, back to Oregon. I was in 2 penitentiaries and I don't know how many jails. I even joined the Army and got kicked out of that during a shooting war. In 1946, I was back in the United States on a street called Fifth Street in Los Angeles. I came to one morning and I was petting a cat. But when I came to, I found out the cat wasn't a cat, it was an alley rat. Somehow, some way, I had heard about AA. I don't know how, because that isn't what they were calling it when I left my husband. But I put a nickel on the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And 2 men came. Again, in 1946, Alcoholics Anonymous was far ahead of anything here in the United States, because the people who came to me was a big, tall, red-headed Texan and a little black man. My sponsor became Tex Adams. My spiritual advisor became Fred Mendel, the little black man. I went to their first meeting. I had a convulsion, and AA started working for me. It seems that they had put me in Georgia Street Receiving, and from Georgia Street Receiving, my husband had been called. He flew out, and they committed me to Camarilla for 9 months. I never would have made it had they not done that. Had Alcoholics Anonymous in those days tried to take on the professions like they do today, a lot of us would have died. But they knew enough to seek out the professionals. They knew I needed the treatment I got. They hung in there, they stayed with me, they were always somebody with me. I went into convulsions 14 days after my last drink, and I had intermittent convulsions for about a week. When I left that hospital, I left as a vegetable. I had had too many shock treatments. They told me I would never talk. They told my husband I would never talk. But he believed, and because he believed, I know sometimes before he died, he wished that I hadn't been able to talk because I never shut my mouth. About the only thing I find that is for me to talk about nowadays is to be a fanatic and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. Because not only did God give me sobriety, he gave me back my mind and my voice. And it must have been for that reason. I stayed in Los Angeles for a while. And just before my third birthday, my husband decided to build a restaurant in Bakersfield. And so before he built the restaurant there, he built me a home. We moved up to Bakersfield, and at that time, they had a little clubhouse down in East Bakersfield on Monterey. And there were a lot of good old-timers there then, too. We stayed there for a number of years. 4, I think, to be exact. And we decided we wanted to retire. So my husband moved on over closer to the Bay Area, and we bought a walnut ranch outside of Dublin. When my husband had 20 years of sobriety, I had 13 years of sobriety. My husband and my son were killed in a fiery automobile accident. I didn't have to get drunk over it. So I left the Bay Area and came to the interior. And I lived in Sacramento, where I've watched it grow from something like 3 meetings a night to maybe 20 or 30 a night. I have seen the beauty of AA. I have seen the things that sort of disturb me in AA. You know, today, I can say what I want to say.
Sure.
12-step calling. It's like a taxi cab service. They call you up and they want you to fix it. They want to go to some big $10,000, from $3,000 to $10,000 recovery house, where they can zap them with some pills and fix them. They don't want to put out any effort and get somebody to go on 12-step calls is next to impossible. It's the backbone of the program, working with the drunk. But I think what's happened is that we who have been around a long time forget to teach the newcomer. This is a learning program. To me, it's learning how to live. You know, normally, I don't call this a program when I'm talking to a group of people. I refer to it as a way of life, a totally new way of life. I don't refer to people who don't drink as normies, because Alcoholics Anonymous did 3 things for me. It put me back into society. It taught me to care. And it made me a normie. I am a human being today who has an illness. And it's called alcoholism. And I recognize it. I recognize the difference in my illness and drug addiction. I know that if I shoot something in my arm long enough, I'm going to get hooked. But when I drank socially accepted and legal. And I didn't know I was going to get hooked. I didn't know I had this terrible disease. And I have a disease. I am not a narcotic. I am not an addict. And all of our new people that are treating alcoholism, proselyting on the illness alcoholism, let's see, are lumping our alcoholism in with chemical addiction. And we're getting all these beautiful young people who come in that have found out they could get rid of their other addictions but can't get rid of alcoholism, but they still come in lumping it with the chemical addiction. It bothers me. Because we are separate. We are separate. We did not do it to ourselves. We have an addiction. You know, it's the same thing if I was addicted to strawberries. I couldn't eat them. It's that simple. And yet, you know, I am addicted to strawberries. And I have been known to go to a store and pick a strawberry up and eat it. So that must say that I'm emotionally addicted to my addictions, my allergies, the same as I am to alcohol. I don't have any argument with my illness at all. I've watched AA grow in this area in Woodland. One meeting a week to what, 10 or 12 now? You said you went to a meeting in Willits. There was no AA there for a long time. There was no meetings in Dixon. We've got 8 there in the last 2 years. I have seen great things happening. Great things happening. This town right here, Vacaville, up until 3 years ago, I had one meeting. One meeting. And then myself and 2 other girls started a group called How. Because we didn't like the newcomer left standing. We wanted a traditional meeting. And we wanted it to not be in a fellowship. We wanted it autonomous. So that we could keep it to tradition. And we could keep it to the program. And you know, it's working. I went to a meeting last Friday night, and there were over 40 people in that little meeting. But since we opened that meeting, there have been 12 other meetings opened in this town. All they had to do is show it could be done. You know, if we were out in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and we built 100 bedroom hotel and said it was for alcoholism, we would have to build another one before the year was out. Because I don't care where you go, there's alcoholics who need help. Ah, the growth of Northern California has been stupendous. It is a little bit behind Southern California. It started out here on the West Coast in San Francisco with a non-alcoholic lady who got a hold of the big book and gave it to her roommate. And he got other friends, and it just grew and mushroomed. The same thing happened with 5 Men in Los Angeles. 5 Men at the Cecil Hotel, and it grew and it mushroomed. So what happens here is that we're a little bit behind. We're growing. We're getting bigger. Next Monday we open an inner group, which is, that's something.
It's beautiful.
We are always reaching out, always looking for something new. I, in particular, am interested in young people. An old bag like me. But I wasn't this old nor this ugly when I came to this fellowship, you know. I just got that way in 40 years. But when you talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, I could sit here and go back and forth and back and forth. If we were having a two-way conversation, because there's nothing like it in the world. There is no way, until they find the cause of alcoholism. And you know, people tell me, when I talk about the covered wagon days, you know, they say, but times are changing. I have an answer for that. Okay, times are changing. Now, if you will show me where the ravages of the illness called alcoholism have changed, then I will change the program that makes it better. Until then, I'm going to stick to the grassroots ways. I'm going to pitch the steps. And I'm going to pitch Chapter 5. I'm going to pitch that big book. You know, the 12 traditions came along after I was sober a while. I helped make them. I did everything wrong, you know. So now I fight for them. You know, I voted against the 12 traditions. Oh, yeah. They told us, our trustees, we were going to have some non-alcoholics in there. And my opinion was, they've been trying to run our lives all this time. No way! You know? It's like we had this little old clubhouse in Bakersfield. And all of a sudden, a bunch of goopies come in. It was all secondhand furniture. The floor was rough. It had cracks in it. It was a scuzzy place. But we were happy. And then something called Al-Anon. God, they came in and they took down our plastic drapes and made new drapes. They had the floors sanded and the podium was stained and fixed up, you know. And the kitchen had new congolian put on it. And we were furious.
They changed it.
Well, these non-alcoholics, let me tell you, they butted into all our lives. Now they're butting into our AA life. Ain't no way. And the first time they let an Al-Anon stand at the podium, I'll have you know I got up and walked out. You bet your life. They didn't have anything to offer me, and I wasn't about to listen to them. Now I realize how lovely they are. And I don't let them interfere in my life even yet. Mm-hmm. I listen to them. And I take a little and I leave a little. But these changes I had to live through. I had to live through these proselyters who proselyte our illness. It's okay. We were talking earlier about being friendly with our friends. But these money makers, I don't understand. Even our detoxes here in our area bother me. The counties, and everybody puts money into them. But you know, you have to pass a screening test if you get to stay on the 30-day program. The rest of the time, you're booted right back out in 3 or 5 days to where you came from. You go out with the same problems. Nobody there to care or show you they care. They give you 3 to 5 days to sober up and say, go to AA. Well, these guys have come out of the bushes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nobody to care. I wonder where I would be had not, almost 40 years ago, two people who had been sober a little over 4 years come down the skid row to pick me up as dirty as I was.
That was Tex Adams and who was the little black guy?
Fred Mandel.
Fred Mandel.
Where would I be today?
That's right.
You know? We don't do it. I did as long as I could. You know, if somebody called me and said, I'm sick, I think I'm going to die, I would go and find out if they were going to die. If somebody called me and said, I want to commit suicide, I would go to make sure they didn't. I didn't go to be their savior. You know, I went to help them, to help them find a better way of life. And that's what bothers me today, that we are not aware of our newcomers enough, that we're too caught up in our own. You know, I got mine. You.
Go find yours.
Yeah. You know, and there are those who will sit in a meeting, go to one meeting a week, and listen to the same thing over and over and over, and say the same thing over, and they're not going to grow anymore. You know, they're satisfied where they are. They never go to a conference. They never go into juvenile hall with us. You know, do you realize we have 9-year-olds that are alcoholics? My young man came this weekend, surprised me from Florida. Now that kid came in when he was 15 and a half years old. Got 11 years of sobriety today. But supposing that I had said to him, you're too young. You don't know what it's all about. And that's what they're telling the kids today. What do you mean a 9-year-old an alcoholic? He's too young. But he has 10 months of sobriety. And he's not going to juvenile hall anymore. But you can't get people to go there. I have people from the mental institution that were going in and coming out and going in and coming out. They were never telling them they were alcoholics here. And yet here in Napa County, I have at least 7 on the streets, one of them with 8 years of sobriety, never been back to a mental institution. People don't want to put themselves out for the program. And I don't know how to show them how to do it. The only way I can show them is to try to teach the people I sponsor. And all of my people that I sponsor, I've advised to go to the Big Book Seminar and learn more about the Big Book. Learn more about the Big Book. It is the text of Alcoholics Anonymous. Go learn more about it. I think there's a lot I could learn about it, and God willing, if I'm well enough, I'll be there.
We'll probably see you there. I want to ask you a couple of things.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to go back. I want to take you back. I want to talk about Tex. I want to talk about the hole in the ground.
Oh.
And the things that went on there. Mm-hmm. But I want to go all the way back to when you and your husband drank with Bill Wilson, or Willie Wilson, as you said you called him, at the Metropole.
Yeah.
And I'm not asking you to create or romanticize
anything.
But can you give me an impression of Bill Wilson at that time?
When he was drinking?
Yeah.
He was a complete slob.
That's
as romantic as you can be about Bill Wilson.
Well, there's a lot of people would do that, would romanticize. Oh, he was
no way,
tall,
no
tall,
way.
Good
Bill was a slob. He was long, lanky, drooly, argumentative, know-it-all. He was a slob. He didn't get along too well with other people. Wound up with a lot of black eyes. Fell down. Oh, God, he could fall down more than any person I ever saw. Bill was Bill.
Was that near Wall Street?
Well, it was just down. See, Amo was at the Waldorf.
Amo was a cook, a chef at the Waldorf.
Yeah. And Bill was at, and it was kind of midway on Broadway there. So they kind of met. I think Bill was probably heading for the subway and never made it.
So then what?
And besides, they gave doubles there.
They gave doubles for the price of singles?
That's right.
Well, then you said when we talked before that he just then appeared to just kind of drop out of sight.
He disappeared.
He disappeared from you.
Mm-hmm. And was gone for... Well, we didn't really know about it then until 38 or 39 where he was. Of course, I don't know when he disappeared, but he'd been disappeared for a long time. We thought he was dead like everybody else, you know.
Yeah, he just faded.
He was one of the
real close barroom friends, and he just...
Just went somewhere.
You really missed him.
Not really.
And then you and your husband had... Was it a chain of restaurants?
Yeah.
Anyway, you wound up in Akron.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you real sick.
Mm-hmm.
Called for the house physician.
And it was Dr. Bob.
And it was Dr. Bob Smith.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to help you.
He wanted to help both of us.
As well as your husband.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened, the outcome of that was, what hospital was it? Was it Towns that he was taking people
to?
Oh,
no, he was taking the Catholic hospital there.
Catholic hospital?
Mm-hmm. Where Sister Ignatius was.
Okay, did you ever get a chance to meet her? Or did you ever
Later in
life?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well then, Dr. Bob, give me your impressions of him without any romanticizing. This is
Dr.
fascinating.
Dr. Bob,
yeah.
You've got to romanticize.
Do you?
He was big. He was hearty. Had big hands. Had a voice that just... When he laughed, he shook the rafters. He loved a sick alcoholic. Bob was precious. He could be very firm without being firm. I think at times probably, I don't know, but I think he had to be firm with Bill. Bill had a habit, I think. Now, this is not, you know, out of the oat bag. But knowing Bill, I would think he'd grab the reins and run, you know. And I think maybe Bob was his anchor. Bob was Mr. Serenity. That's it. Bob was easygoing, loving, kind, understanding, giving. Bob was Bob. And Anne was just as sweet as he was.
Did you have an opportunity to meet her at that time?
Yes.
Well, tell me then, when he came to your room, the two of you in the hospital or in the room.
I never met Anne at that time.
Okay, you're sicker than hell.
Mm-hmm.
What did he do at that point?
He wanted us to go to the hospital, but I wouldn't go.
You wouldn't go, but...
Emma would, so he took the one that would. Then nobody was forced to do anything. So I got the car keys and went home.
What did he say to you? That's 50 years ago.
Yes, almost. Somehow or other.
Do you remember what...
It seems like he told me that I was a very sick person and that I should go to the hospital and he could help me. And... that I could only get sicker, not better. And he preached a lot of God to me. I want to hear any of it. He was not persuasive as far as... He did not impress me at that time. It had to be a number of years later that Bob impressed me. You know?
Yeah.
It's like... when I went to Toronto to the conference and met Sister Ignatius. I think that was her last conference, I'm not sure. But she was such a loving little person, you know. There were a lot of impressive people in AA.
In Akron, did he take Emil in his car?
Yeah.
To the Catholic hospital,
yeah.
You said. The Catholic hospital. Mm-hmm. And apparently that's the one where Sister
That's
Ignatius
where
was.
Sister Ignatius took them in.
Okay, and then when you sobered up, did you go to the hospital?
No.
Or did you sober up?
I was long gone.
Okay, as soon as
Emil left, I left that sucker.
And you went back to New York?
Yeah.
What, how old were you and what was the date? Do you remember?
Oh, like I said, it was early. I don't remember it exactly.
38, 39?
37 or 38, somewhere around there.
Okay, so this has been a couple of...
Because I had left Emil very shortly after that and I was gone 7 years.
Okay, so you went back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then Emil
stayed
about
there.
A month later?
About a month later, Emil came home.
Pardon? What, do you know Emil's sobriety date?
That's what I'm trying to figure.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't even know the year for sure. It's like I don't know what year I was in what penitentiary. I was drinking, you know? And it's a hard thing. I don't ever tell my story. I'm always amazed at people who can get up and give you a drunkalogue for their first drink. Because I wasn't conscious that much. I had a lot of blackouts. And there's a lot of places I was that I wasn't. Like I like to tell people in AA, the only reason I'm here is because once I wasn't all there, you know. But there's a lot of things I don't remember that I wish I did. Maybe I'm glad I don't.
You might be prefer yeah. not to, yeah.
yeah.
Well, then, so then he came back to New York, and then he started kind of, the Negro housekeeper kind of took care of you. He kept you locked up, took your clothes away.
Yeah.
Kind of enabled you or whatever, trying to protect you or whatever.
Oh, he wasn't enabling me. He took all my booze away from me,
well,
too.
Okay, he took all the booze away. And you said, the heck with this. So you took off down to the landing,
mm-hmm.
went out and got some booze and went on this seven-year trip to
yeah.
Portland and geographical all,
over the world.
Yeah, Cuba and everything, I think you mentioned, mm-hmm. and so forth. So you wound up down on Fifth Street. What do you use as your sobriety date?
October the 28th, 1946.
Okay, so October
the 28th. That's the day I walked out of the mental hospital, because I figure the 9 months before that was enforced sobriety, and I don't claim it.
All right. And when Tex Adams and
Fred Mendel.
Fred, you told me that three times, and I'm going to have to write it down to remember. But anyway, they took you to the hole in the wall.
Is that hole in the ground.
Hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the convulsion there?
Yeah.
And so that's when they decided they'd better get you to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result of that, the hospital notified Emil where you were.
No, Tex notified Emil.
Tex notified Emil where you were. And then Emil just dropped everything and came out here.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you've been gone 7 years.
He had detectives looking for me all that 7 years.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that must have been an expensive proposition.
Well, we had good business. He nearly killed me, you know. He never closed our account at Chase National Bank. And in those days, we could make out counter checks, you know. We didn't have to have them printed up. And if I was well enough to make out a counter check and then run like hell, I could get away from him.
So it was kind of a paper trail in a
yeah.
sense
mm-hmm.
around the country, and
That's
he was
right.
trying to run you down.
That's right.
You said he almost killed you. What do you mean?
Well, he should have closed the account.
Oh, that's what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Close out the account, and then you wouldn't have been able to
that's
do that.
That's right. If he had taken our business or taken me off the checks, you know.
Okay, so he comes out now, and you've been put in Camarillo, I
mm-hmm.
guess, by the time he gets here.
No, he signed the papers.
Oh, he signed, he came out. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so you're still in the hospital
I'm
or whatever.
I'm still in the L.A. psycho.
And still in L.A. psycho in a county psycho.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes out and he signs the commitment papers
mm-hmm.
and establishes business there. Now, he's 7 years sober
mm-hmm.
by this time. So this has got to be around 45. Yeah. Well, anyway, your sobriety date's October 46. Yeah. So it's been in February of 46.
January or February, somewhere around there.
And he starts a business there or what? Now, what?
Well, what he did is he bought into, for the first year or so, while I was in the hospital, he bought a barbecue restaurant in Rosemead, I think it was, and it nearly drove him nuts. He said, "My God, it's like a grocery store here out here on the West Coast."
Fast foods or something?
Fast foods. They didn't understand Epicurean cooking, you know. And he was going insane. So he just couldn't cook out here.
So anyway, he went into business, and apparently you were in Camarillo at this time and came out. Tell me, there's so much history involved with that group of five that started at the hotel, the mother group.
Yeah.
And a lot of that now you've gotten secondhand, but you did know Tex Adams.
Oh yeah.
And not
and
only
Sybil.
That, but you I believe are a sponsor of Ann, his favorite niece.
Addie.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about that hole in the ground. It's like, I've never been there, and I just
oh,
would love to go.
Oh, you want to go there before they close it? The neighborhood's getting too rough, and they're going to close the hole in the ground. The hole in the ground is down under a woman's club. And you go down some steps and go into it. It has a toilet that stinks, has always stunk. No matter, they put new floors and everything in it, but it's where the drunks go. The hole in the ground has catered to Skid Row since its beginning, its very beginning. Poncho got sober there. So many of the old timers that are dead and gone now. Duke Carson, Tokay. You know, Tokay was a black man. And he used to say, "I'm Tokay and I'm okay." But Tokay died and we never knew his real name. And he's buried as Tokay.
Tokay, okay.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a man that we called the Messiah. He was there. There was a one-armed Indian there named John Zelazar. There was a crazy Indian there called Crazy Charlie. He's still alive. There was a blind man there who said he was only slightly handicapped. That's Ira Hansen. Of course, Sybil was there. Manuel Rios was there. Oh, God.
Is Einar Hansen the one who eventually got into rehabilitation? There's an Einar Hansen that was blind for almost from birth. As a youngster he got blind.
Mm-hmm.
And he did quite a bit of talking as far as... Now, the thing that amazes me is what he could tell you about the disease of alcoholism. And this man is blind and had to learn all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Memorize the big book?
Mm-hmm. We would go to his house down in Santa Monica. And nobody could cook breakfast. We'd stay all night. Einar would cook breakfast. He would pour the coffee. He would do it all himself. Nobody waited on Einar. He did it himself. We had some characters that wouldn't quit in the early days. Some of us didn't even have... I was known as Yabut.
Yabut.
And Tex would say, when I'd say... He'd say something to me, and I'd say, "Yabut," and he'd say, "I'm not talking to you anymore. You're not listening to me." He had an iron hand in a velvet glove.
Tell me a little bit about Tex Adams. Did he become your sponsor by virtue of the 12-step call, or is that a relationship that developed?
No, hell, he picked me up. I was his.
So he...